Forge Ministries is pleased to welcome R.C. Sproul Jr. with a message entitled Biblical Economics and Nehemiah.
One of my jobs, just one, is that I am a professor at Reformation Bible College. And my area of expertise includes the teaching of philosophy. And just a few weeks ago, I had my first class of the semester with a group of fresh new students on ancient philosophy. Now, when you teach at a Bible college, you can't expect to have a great number of students show up having already been moderately well trained in philosophy. It's all going to be foreign to them, and generally speaking, some of them anyway are going to not like it too much. And I talked about that. I said, you know, philosophy creates one of two responses. Either you love it to pieces because what you're doing is you're examining things you've never examined before, or you're going to hate it because you're asking questions about things you already know. One of the things I do in the first week is I introduce them to Zeno's paradox. Anybody ever heard of Zeno's paradox? Zeno was a pre-Socratic philosopher who argued that motion is impossible. And he argued it this way. He argued that if you were to shoot an arrow from here to that wall, before it could get to the wall, it would have to travel halfway between here and the wall. And then, from where it was at halfway, in order to get to the wall, it would have to travel halfway from where it was then to the wall. And halfway, and halfway, and halfway, and thus, it could never hit the wall. And my students said, well, what do you do with the fact that we all know motion happens? And I said to them, why do you know that? I've just proved to you that it's not possible. Why would you trust what your eyes see when your mind has demonstrated its impossibility? That's the kind of thing we're talking about. Are we belaboring the obvious? I also introduced in the first week to the Greek philosopher Parmenides. Probably none of you have heard of Parmenides, but if you've studied philosophy at all, you would have known about him. He is remembered. He's not obscure. He's certainly not rock star status like Socrates or Plato or Aristotle, but he's pretty important. And Parmenides was perhaps the first philosopher. He made it onto the scene, though. His thing that he's remembered for, his emblematic affirmation was this. Parmenides said, whatever is, is. It was a lot easier to get into the Philosophical Hall of Fame back then at the beginning. Whatever is, is. All right? I'm down with that. And actually, when we look at it, we break it down and we compare Parmenides with Heraclitus, who is a little bit more sophisticated. Heraclitus is famous for saying, whatever is, is changing. And there was this great titanic intellectual battle between Parmenides and his disciples and Heraclitus and his disciples that, again, we still talk about thousands of years later. Well, economics is kind of like philosophy. It's not something that very many of us have a lot of training in. And a lot of us have a lack of interest in it because we're either talking about things so abstract that we think it has no bearing on our lives, or we're talking about things that are so plain and obvious and we're cutting them and slicing them and looking them under a microscope that we feel like we're wasting our time. In fact, the reality is that economics has for many years been known as the dismal science. So what does that say about you that you chose this afternoon to hear me talk for an hour about a biblical view of the dismal science as it relates to Nehemiah? Are you going to be really proud on Monday when you're talking with your friends and they say, what did you do this weekend? And you're going to say, oh, I listened to a guy talk about biblical economics in Nehemiah. He's not going to be real jealous of you, I should tell you. Well, there's a reason why economics is called the dismal science. A number of reasons, one of which is this thing that we've already talked about. It can be profoundly abstract. It can fall into charts and graphs and numbers, and unless you're some sort of math geek, that's not too terribly interesting. In fact, even for me, who chose where I went to college so that I could study economics, when I got there, I didn't major in economics for the express reason that to do so, I would have had to take a year of accounting. I wasn't going to deal with that many numbers. I changed my major and ended up majoring in philosophy and literature. So there's a lot of numbers, there's a lot of abstract thinking. There's another problem, though, that gives us this name, the dismal science. One, you don't become a rock star economist by preaching good news. You don't get to go on CNN or MSNBC in order to just say, well, everything's fine. It's going to continue to be fine. No. What you do, you've got to be Chicken Little if you want to make the big time in economics. You've got to warn the world that the end is near. So they're generally a bunch of grumpy people. But even though we might all need to do that in order to be famous, the other problem with economics is economists. They're constantly disagreeing with each other. You know, there's not a gravity school and an anti-gravity school in physics. But in economics, there's all sorts of different schools with all sorts of different perspectives, all sorts of different models. We argue with each other, we bicker with each other, so much so that it's been said that if you were to take all the economists in the world and reach them and stack them end to end, they still wouldn't reach a conclusion. That's how bad it is. So why are we talking about it? Well, friends, we're talking about it because the Bible talks about it. Economics isn't the exploration of subatomic particles. Economics is the study of our calling to be stewards of God's creation. It touches, and the Bible touches, on work, on wealth, on the poor, on saving, on spending, on priorities. It is everywhere you turn running into difficult and important ethical questions. The most people that don't want to talk about stuff want your stuff. When you show up and say, well, this is what the Bible says, they're upset because we're getting in the way of them getting your stuff. But here's the reality. If we understand economics, the first principle we have to understand is that we have no stuff. Going back to where we started the other day, Genesis 1:1a, the first economic principle you've got to get down to your toes is this: God owns everything. God owns everything and everyone. It's all His. If you don't get that, you don't get economics. Let's go back not to Nehemiah, but again to Genesis 1 and 2. When God makes Adam and Eve, He puts them in the garden. Well, first He makes Adam. And He gives Adam the first scientific enterprise. You know what Adam was, the first scientific enterprise was? Adam is called to name the animals. And this was not a sort of parlor game, like Pictionary or Balderdash, where God just thought, let's see how funny Adam can be in coming up with funny names for these animals. You know, and Adam's trying to play along and he's saying, hippopotamus, that's a hippopotamus. And then waddles this weird looking thing, oh, that must be a platypus. That's not what's going on here. What's going on actually goes to the question that Parmenides and Heraclitus struggled with. It goes to how do we understand the variety of the world in its unity, the one and the many. And in naming the animals, what he's doing is he's doing the practice of taxonomy. He's naming, this is like this. But it's different like this. And you know what taxonomy, who knows the categories? Taxonomic categories. Someone must have learned that somewhere. I never did. Say it like you mean it. Sorry. Please say it like you mean it. You don't mean it, do you? Species. Kind. Yep. Family. Yep. Isn't there a sort of a mnemonic memory song thing that helps you remember? Nobody remembers that? Well, I can't blame you since I don't remember it either. And I was just talking about this in class. I should know it. But this is what Adam is doing. And in doing this, he's beginning the calling of exercising dominion. He's called to exercise dominion. Now, in Genesis 1 or Genesis 2. Well, let me just say it this way. One of the things that I love about Genesis 1 and 2 is that when God is describing His creation, it's not just the creation that He describes. One of the recurring refrains in the history is this: God saw that it was good. So God not only does the act of speaking reality into existence, but He goes and He assesses His own work and He pronounces His judgment on it. And so every day, and God saw that it was good, and God saw that it was good, and God saw that it was good. Now we all know that Genesis 3 is coming. And so we can hear the beginning of the scary movie music in the background, because we know as soon as we turn that page of Genesis 3, it's going to begin, "Now the serpent was more cunning than any of the beasts of the field." But the reality is, it's before Genesis 3 that God said something was not good. Before the serpent shows up, before Adam and Eve fall into sin, God says something's not good. What was it? It's not good that man should be alone. Now, why is that not good? Is God thinking, "Oh, Adam, goodness gracious, if I don't get you a wife, you're going to end up wearing stripes and polka dots together. You have no fashion sense at all. You're going to need a wife to tell you what to wear." That's not the problem. Ladies, I'm also sorry that the problem isn't that that Adam was thinking to himself, "I'm so lonely, I need someone to share my heart with. I need someone to do my nails with." That wasn't the problem. The reason we know that is because we know that Adam had only one responsibility. The only problem there could be is that God called Adam to do something and Adam wasn't equipped to do it without the help. And what was that thing? The dominion mandate. Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, and everything that creeps upon the ground. Does that sound like an economic enterprise? What God has done is He places Adam and Eve and He puts them in this garden. And this garden, will you ever ask yourself this question? Without sin, before there was sin, if you left the garden, what would you run into out there? What does a unfallen jungle look like? Do you step on some quicksand and you sink in a little bit, but while you're sinking in, you get a nice little, calf massage because it's all good, and then it lifts you gently back up, and you've had a pedicure while you were down there too, and you move on. Is that it? I mean, really, when you walk out of the garden, you might see a lion in the jungle, but lying right beside him is a lamb. There's no sin. There's no fall yet. So what's the difference between the garden and what's outside the garden? I want to suggest to you that the difference is that the garden is finished and the jungle is not. That the function of the garden is to be a place of security, a place of blessing, a place of worship, a place where they walk with God in the cool of the evening. But the dominion mandate is to go out and gardenize the jungle. Here's your model, God is saying to Adam and Eve. Here's what it's supposed to look like at the end out there. I've given you a job to do. You're to reflect my glory in how I created this world by doing the same kind of thing out there. Well, that was before the fall, right? But Adam and Eve fell into sin, and that blew up that whole plan, right? Adam and Eve eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They disobey God. And God comes into the garden. Oh, sin. Sin is so destructive. Sin, the first thing I think sin does to us is it makes us stupid. That's why we have the R.C. Sproul Jr. Principle of Hermeneutics. It's because of sin. Sin makes us stupid. Here's Adam thinking to himself, okay, now, a week ago, there was nothing but God. And this entire universe, all the stars in the sky, this entire planet, God spoke all of this into reality in the space of 6 days. And now we've disobeyed Him, and here He comes. This God who made everything in the space of 6 days. Maybe if we get behind this tree that He made, He won't see us. Sin makes us stupid. So God, surprise, surprise, finds them. And sin, we find out, also makes us cowardly. Adam, did you eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? What's Adam say? It was the woman. Right? Adam, who's been called to protect and to nurture and to care for Eve and to guard her, now hides behind her skirt and throws her under the bus. Sin makes us stupid, sin makes us cowardly, but it also makes us bold. Not content with throwing her under the bus, He finds a bigger target. It was the woman that You gave Me. You know, Lord, I remember those golden hours back in the day. I was in this paradise, we would walk together in the cool of the evening, and I'm naming the animals, and everything's going along great. I take a little nap, and You go do all this, and look what You've done. You've ruined everything. He blames God. God turns His attention to Eve. And He says, because you have done this, greatly will be your pain in childbearing. Now, I've never given birth to a child, though I certainly had the physique for it. I have, however, given birth to more kidney stones than my brother Hopkins has children here. I know about pain, having given birth to all these kidney stones. And I should tell you, they say that kidney stone pain is equivalent to childbirth pain. And I've actually known women who've done both, and they say the kidney stone pain is worse. But you know, even if it's a tie, ladies, I'm sympathetic for that pain, but even if it's a tie, never once when I passed a kidney stone was there a doctor there to catch it, clean it up, wrap it in a blanket, and give it to me to hold. I never looked down at one of my kidney stones and said, you'll take care of me in my old age. Never named them. Megadeth. That's a good name. Despite the reality of that pain, I believe that when Eve heard this curse, she rejoiced. Because she understood what it meant. In pain you will bring forth children. And she's thinking, I'm going to have children? What I heard was, the day I eat the fruit, I'll die. What I'm hearing now is, not only am I not going to die on this day, but I'm going to keep my job. I'm still going to be called to be fruitful and multiply, to fill the earth and subdue it. So then when God turns His attention to Adam and He says, by the sweat of your brow will you get your bread, there'll be thorns and there'll be thistles. Adam's already figured this out. I get it. I get it. Our job is going to be a lot more difficult. But the job remains. You see the same principle when Noah and his family get off the ark. What does God say? Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule of the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, and everything creeps upon the ground. It hasn't stopped. And the glorious thing is that we're doing it. I've already told you that I watched movies. This might make me more worldly in your eyes, but I've also read the Chronicles of Narnia many, many, many times. I'm also the president of the loyal, royal order of reading the Narnia Chronicles in the proper original order. I stand deeply and firmly opposed to those Gnostic rationalists who want us to read the story in chronological order. No, no, no. We start with the lion, the witch, and the wardrobe the way God meant us to. That said, of all the seven stories, my favorite is The Magician's Nephew. Chronologically, the first one. In large part because of the beauty and the glory of the creation account. What happens in that story is that Polly and Diggory, the cabbie, Queen Jadis, and Uncle Andrew are all in this empty world where there's nothing there. There's no light, there's no sound, there's just nothing there. And in the distance they hear this single steady but beautiful note. It begins out faintly and it begins to increase in intensity and it begins to come closer. And as the note is being played slowly in the sky, the first hint of lights from the stars begin to appear. And eventually the very feel of the ground becomes solid under their feet. And then it begins to rumble and to bubble like a toasted cheese sandwich. And out of these bubbles, shaking off the dirt, come the animals of Narnia. We get this picture of the fecundity of this unfallen dirt when these newly created animals get a little confused about Uncle Andrew. See, Uncle Andrew is the bad guy in the story. And he had this wild mop of hair because, you know, bad guys have lots of hair. Sound literary principle. They have a lot of hair, they're the bad guy. Well, the animals see this wild mop of hair and they think that his hair is a set of roots. They think that he is a plant that has come out from the ground, and they dig a little hole, and they turn them upside down to get those roots in the ground, and they begin to pour more dirt into the hole where they put them, and pour water into the hole. And while this happens, Uncle Andrew's coins fall out of his pocket. Now this was in a day when money was money. So he had gold coins and he had silver coins. And again, the soil was so rich that where the coins hit the ground, out grew gold and silver trees. This is what the ground was like. By the way, spoiler alert, but if you haven't read the Chronicles of Narnia, you deserve this, to have spoilers happen in front of you. While they were still in England, the evil, wicked Empress Jadis had pulled the crossbar off of a light post there in the city of London, and she carried it with her into this world. And she throws it in desperation at Aslan. And it bounces off his nose, unharmed. He's utterly unharmed, and it falls into the ground, and guess what happens right there? A lantern grows out of the ground in lantern waste, which gets us back to the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. That's why you read it in this order, so that these old mysteries can be revealed to you, so you can find out why the wardrobe works. Also a part of this story. I belabor that, friends, to remind you of what Eden must have been like. How fruitful that ground must have been before the thorns and the thistles. Because I've got to tell you, it's still amazing after the fall. Look around this room. Do you realize that because of our calling to exercise dominion, to go into the jungle and gardenize it, do you realize that what we have done is that we have taken, that this entire room, everything in this room, was once dirt. Everything in this room was once dirt. Now, some of that dirt fed grass. And that grass fed cows. And those cows became hamburgers for my belly and shoes for my feet. Some of that grass fed sheep, and the sheep became wool, which made this carpet. Some of that dirt was dug up out of deep into the ground. It was sifted and shifted and heated and cooled and mixed and matched and heated again and turned into this metal. It was all dirt. Everything here was once dirt. I experienced this about 5 years ago. My friends at Answers in Genesis every year sponsor a scholar's tour of the Grand Canyon where they have some donors who support this project where the goal is to take guys who aren't experts on creation issues, some of whom are going to be young earth, some of whom are not going to be young earth, and to take them on a highly subsidized trip down the Grand Canyon with Answers in Genesis teachers. When I went, this trip that would have cost $3,000, I paid $300 for. And I went because we got an invitation in the mail, and my wife thought, this is wonderful, this is amazing, this is something else, you need to do this, dear. And I said, yes, a man needs to do this. Someone who likes to be outside needs to do this. Someone who likes to be in a hot desert likes what needs to do, but not me. And she, God bless this woman, she got it for me for my birthday against my wishes. Happy birthday, dear. You're going to go out in the Grand Canyon for a week. Well, I went, and I'm glad I went. It was a great trip. It was a life-changing trip. But one of the things that happens when you go on these tours in the Grand Canyon is you leave nothing behind. And there's nothing there waiting for you. You live in this world where everything man-made is on your boat, and there's nothing man-made in the canyon. When your boat comes to stop, it stops to set up camp on a sandbar, and that sandbar might not have been there a week ago. There's not even a little metal ring to tie your boat up onto it. There's nothing, nothing man-made. In case I'm not even being sufficiently clear, there is a box that goes on the boat, and it comes off the boat when you stop. And it goes back on the boat when you get back to go back down the river. And I don't even want to tell you what's in that box, but I'm telling you, nothing is left behind. All right. Some of us got it. It gives you this sense of how much we take for granted the miracle of work and dominion. To live in that world where there is nothing man-made, and now to come into this place where not only do we have voice projection and comfortable chairs and leather and wool, we have air conditioning. This is gardenizing this jungle of Texas. I live in Florida. The whole entire state literally is a sandbar. If you go into Florida and you take your hand will do fine. You don't even need a tool. And you just scoop up the grass. 2 inches beneath the bottom of the grass is sand. It's like a like all the grass is like a carpet that's been laid on top of the sand. All the pavement is like carpet that's been laid on top of it. It's just sand under there. And yet, I go to sleep every night in 73 degrees in glory at 73 degrees. I go from place to place in more dirt that takes me from one place to another at over 60 miles an hour while blowing comfortable cold air on me, while burning liquid dirt that we get out of the ground. That's what economics is. That's what dominion is. That's what happens when we work, when we labor, like they did in Nehemiah. In Nehemiah, we're told the people had a mind to work, and what they did is they took rocks, and they took rubble, and they took dirt, and they took water, and they took straw, and they mixed this stuff together, and they built a wall of security and protection. They gardenized their jungle. They took the raw materials and made something useful and something beautiful out of them. And ultimately, all raw materials are is dirt. I'm even more astonished at this when I'm working at home, because so much of my work consists of me rubbing these fingers against little pieces of dirt. Now again, liquid dirt, petroleum that was treated and heated and sifted and turned into plastic. And I do this on the plastic, and it interfaces with another kind of dirt. We call it sand. And the sand has been etched and shaped into what we call semiconductors or microprocessors. And while I'm rubbing my fingers, words and ideas are coming up on this screen, which is made out of sand. And it goes out to the whole world. Anybody in the world can read these things from anywhere. Do you understand how astonishing that is? We're so jaded and ungrateful for the economic miracle that we're witnessing and still living through. There's lots of bad news, friends. I could give you plenty of bad news. Let me give you this little bit of bad news, a little simple principle. If you ever hear an economist saying, war is good for the economy, run from your life. Don't give them any money. Don't give them any attention. Don't give them any platform. They don't know what they're talking about. Why do we think war is good for the economy? Because when you break stuff, that's what war is. War is breaking stuff. When you break stuff, then you got to make new stuff to fix it, right? Or to replace it. And that need to replace the stuff, that's the engine of economic growth. That's what we call Keynesian thinking in economics. Break stuff so we can increase demand for stuff, and that will make us all wealthy. What we need is more demand. But any sound economist will tell you this, that our demand is always infinite. Do you realize you never can get too much? If you had all, I mean, I think about this all the time. If, you know, there are jobs I don't do now that I can't imagine that I didn't do years ago. Years ago I couldn't imagine I wouldn't do now. I thought, this is so basic, this is so simple, this is such a small thing. Why would I pay someone to do this? And now at this part of my life, I'm thinking, well, I've got this covered, I've got that covered, I've got that covered, I've still got some money left. I'm going to pay somebody to do this. I have somebody cut my grass. Somewhere along the line, I realized, you know, if I go on one more trip and speak at one more conference every year, I can pay to have my grass cut all year long. I'm going to do that. Because I like doing this a whole lot more than I like cutting the grass. You don't get wealthy by breaking stuff. You get wealthy by making stuff. Because that's what wealth is. It's stuff. It's little pieces of jungle that's become a little piece of garden. That's what wealth is. It's dirt turned into something. something that people value, something that you value. I'm persuaded at the end of the day that there are really two competing views of economics in the world. One that says wealth comes from making stuff, the other that says wealth just comes. And the root of the distinction between these, I believe, goes back to Genesis 1:1a. Christians believe that God spoke the world into existence. He spoke it and it happened. And because He spoke it and it happened, that's why we affirm that it's all His, right? He made it. Does not the potter have power over the clay? That includes everything that He's made, not just us. That's our story. Our story is that once there was God and He spoke reality into existence. But there's a competing story out there. The competing story is once there was nothing and it, great story, huh? Once there was nothing and it became everything. And everything was disorganized. And the disorganization organized itself. And it was lifeless. And the lifelessness came to life. This is stuff just happening. This is something from nothing. This is rabbits out of hats when there's no rabbit and there's no hat. And no magician. Now, can you see how that would create two different ways of looking at wealth and prosperity? It's not clear. Then imagine this. Imagine that I have consumed less than I produce. I'm a big advocate of that. The first biblical principle is God owns everything. The first biblical law is if you consume more than you produce, you'll become poor. If you consume less than you produce, you'll become wealthy. Very simple. You get those two things, you're way ahead of the rest of the world. So let's suppose that I've consumed less than I produce. And I take some of that surplus, what we call profit, not a bad thing, it's a good thing. It's consuming less than you produce. So I've got this profit, and I'm going to buy a square yard right here. I'm going to go to the owners of the inn and say, I'd like this square yard right here. Would you sell that to me? And we cut a deal. They agree to sell it to me. By the way, who profits when we cut this deal? Let's say that I bought this square yard for $10,000. Who profits? Say it like you mean it. The inn profits. How about me? Do I profit? Oh, yes, I do. Yes, I do. Why do I profit? Here's why I profit. Very simple concept. This is so helpful for you to calm your nerves when you go in and make business deals. You know, when you get upset because someone offers you less than you want or charges you more than you want and you get all bent out of shape. That's not good. That's not wise. I had to teach my wife that. A few months after we were first married, we had a garage sale. And like a lot of people, when we got married, we got more salad bowl sets than we could ever possibly use. More than the Hopkins could ever possibly use. And so my wife had this nice, beautiful salad bowl set. It probably cost about $30 at the store. She had it out there and marked down to $10. And people came and people bought this and people bought that and they didn't buy this and they didn't buy that. And eventually it's now 1 o'clock on Saturday afternoon and someone shows up and says, I'll give you a dollar. My wife comes up to me with smoke coming out of her ears. This woman just offered me a dollar. That cost $30. I had it marked down to $10. That was perfectly fair. She's offered me, can you believe that? I said, well, did you take it? She said, no. I said, well, that's fine. You know why you didn't take it? She said, because that's just outrageous. I said, no, that's not why you didn't take it. The reason you didn't take it is because you'd rather have the salad bowls than a dollar. And the reason she offered you the dollar is because she'd rather have the salad bowls than a dollar. But if you had taken it, then what that would necessarily mean is that you would rather have the dollar than the salad bowls. Right? Remember this. When you go down to the gas station and you're really angry at how much gas costs, remember this. You would rather have the gallon of gas than the $3.50 or you wouldn't do the deal. So whenever we have a free trade, A free trade, both sides necessarily profit because they give up what they value less for what they value more. That's how trades happen. And if they're free and they're honest, nobody gets cheated. So just cool your jets with your jipping accusations. So I paid $10,000 for this square yard. Okay, now back on my story. And with some of my surplus capital, I go out and I buy some tools. And I start digging. And I'm digging into this hole. I get the carpet out of the way. I get the subfloor out of the way. I get a shovel and I'm digging and I'm digging. And I get a backhoe in here. Really small backhoe because it's only a square yard. But I start digging deeper and deeper and deeper. And pretty soon I notice these wonderful shiny flecks down there. It's gold. And suppose I'm working and I'm sifting and I'm doing this thing and I'm accumulating gold out of this land or this little square yard that I bought. And suppose I shape that gold into little coins and I put the gold into a pirate's chest. A great big pirate's chest, okay? Now, whose gold is that? From one perspective, of course, it's God's gold. And you should remember this. Understand when I say God owns all things, I'm not saying the state owns all things, because we need to learn the state is not God. When I'm saying God owns all things, I'm not saying the church owns all things, because we need to learn that the church is not God. What this means, that when God owns all things, that means that when you steal from me, whether you're a private citizen or the state, when you do this, you're not stealing from me, you're stealing from God. God gave it to me to take care of. And when you take it from me, you're taking it from Him. Here's my gold. Is anybody going to dispute that this is my gold? God, it's God's ultimately, but God's put it under my care, right? Because I own the ground, and I did the work, and I got the gold, right? That's mine, right? And are you going to file a claim for some of my gold? Hey man, I was in the audience when you came up with the idea for the illustration. I think I should get some of that. And that's not going to stand, is it? That's the creation account. God does the work of creation, and He owns the stuff. Now let's go to Darwin's account. I don't buy that. I don't dig there. I don't sift. I don't shape. I don't mold. I don't put the coins in a chest. There's just a chest right there. It didn't used to be there. It's just there. It wasn't, and it decided to be. Huh. Well, I'm closest to it. So that should be mine, right? Or it's my illustration, so it should be mine. Does that all sound fair and appropriate? Or might you think, well, we're all in the room. We're all here. And it just, I mean, you didn't make it, artist. It just created itself. So why should that be yours? It should be ours. And maybe some of you would be, yeah, I think that's right. It should be ours. I think that's right. So we said, yeah, let's divide it up. How many coins are there? And how many families do we have? Okay, there's 100 coins for every... Wait a minute, why are we going by families? Shouldn't we go by persons? Right? Why should the Hopkins family, 18 of them, get the same amount as the Sproul family? We're not even half that big. Why should that be? We could go by individuals. Or, you know, a lot of these Hopkins are small little things. They don't need much. They're just little tiny things. Different people have different... Maybe we should go and divide it by pound. Who's with me? Right? We need to divide this gold by pound. You know, if you're interested in learning more about the bi-pound party, please come to our donut festival and be sure to register to vote. See, stuff just happens. If universes just appear, then wealth just appears. And we're left with no way of knowing how to divide it. So what we end up doing is we invest our time and energy in trying to figure out how to divide what we found. We make coalitions. We build political parties. We clamor and we insist and we write our stories about why we should deserve more, or why the pound party is the right way of looking at things. And you know what we're not doing while we're doing all of that? We're not working. If stuff just happens, if stuff just appears, then we're going to devote our time not to making stuff, because you can't make stuff. If stuff's there, it just happens. Think about it this way. Have you ever heard these statistics? Oh, it's so shameful, so wicked, such horrible, horrible things we Americans are. Have you ever heard this? Americans make up 20% of the world's population, and they consume 50% of the world's energy. Greedy, greedy Americans. Americans are 20% of the world's population. But they consume 80% of the world's resources. Greedy, 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 bad people. You know what they never say when they give you those statistics? They never say Americans are 20% of the world's population, but they produce 80% of the world's wealth. See, they look at the stuff as if it's just stuff, as if it's just there. And by the way, it's not just there. You know what a resource is? Something useful. Years ago, in western Pennsylvania, a man by the name of Drake dug a hole in the ground. And out from the ground came a bubbling ooze. He discovered oil. And oil was a great discovery because you could shape it and shift it and mold it. And one of the things that it would do is you could put it into your machinery to keep the dirt and the grit and the sand from messing up your machinery. You could oil things. But in order to get, there's more. Round about that time, we were having an energy crisis. Did you know that? Horrible, horrible Americans made up 20% of the world's population, but they were consuming 80% of the world's whales. They were going out in the ocean, they're killing all the whales, they're bringing the blubber home and using it to light their homes. Turning whale blubber into light. That's gardenizing jungle. But we were running out of whales. Something has to be done. Gotta save the whales. So Drake digs this hole, and not only can you get oil to keep your gears from wearing down, but if you process it, you know what it turns into? It turns into kerosene. And kerosene became the new way that people lit their homes. And there was great rejoicing. Yay! But you know, we're stewards of God's creation, and that created a horrible environmental problem. That process of taking that oil and turning it into kerosene, unfortunately, it created this really toxic, dangerous byproduct, and lots of it. And no one knew what to do with that toxic byproduct. They're thinking maybe we should put it in the salt mines down at the bottom. Maybe we can ship it to some third world country and let them deal with it. That byproduct we call gasoline. Did you know that? Gasoline was a toxic waste problem once upon a time, until the invention of the combustion engine. So remember when I tell you that resources are not just things. They're useful things. And remember, don't forget, that sand that the oil takes care of in our machinery, that's what we make our microchips out of. The sand that we need to get rid of is now the sand that we're protecting in order to make the computers, in order to make us all wealthy. The question is, what are we going to do? And the answer is, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, ruler of the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, and everything that creeps upon the ground. We're going to not steal from our neighbor. We're going to not ask the government to steal from our neighbor. We're going to love our neighbor as ourselves. We're going to do unto him as we'd like to have done unto us. And we're going to serve our neighbor, because the way that you prosper is by taking the jungle in your neighbor's life and turning it into garden. This is why, friends, whatever you do, it's all ministry. You don't make a living unless you're serving your neighbor. I don't know why, but we always use the plumber as the quintessential secular job, and how should we look at this in terms of sacred and secular? Well, I have a much more existential perspective on that. When water is being spilled all over your kitchen, or your sewage is backing up into your bathroom, when you call the plumber, he is kind of ministering to you, isn't he? You really want him to come. You're really grateful for the work that he does. He really takes what's rapidly becoming a jungle, your home, and restores it back into garden standing. That's what we're doing for each other. That's why we should be grateful for each other. Why we should stop the grumbling and the complaining. Stop the bickering over the stuff that just appears. We need to produce and have a mind to work. Friends, this is our Father's world, and he's put us in charge of it. He's made us kings and queens. He's given us kingdoms. I didn't get much chance to talk about the family economy, something near and dear to our friend Kevin's heart. It's near and dear to my own heart too. Let me just say this. This is how you need to look at this as family. When my firstborn son was 4, he had his coronation. I sat him down and I said, "Son, today you are a king. I give you not a crown, not a scepter, but I bestow upon you the royal dust rag, the symbol of your authority. You have been given authority over the baseboards of this house. Your overlord, your mother, is charging you with raining well, son, over these baseboards. She would like you to keep them free of cobwebs and dust and crayon marks, and this is how you shall do it. Lo, with this dust rag. And oh, my son, if you should rule well, rest assured, your kingdom will expand." Because that's what we're doing, you see. That's what this whole idea that you either work or you stay home is completely backwards. We're operating in my house, Sproul Incorporated. We have a job to do, and that's to gardenize the jungle. And that includes making sure toilets don't get stopped up. That includes keeping the baseboards clean. That includes rubbing fingers over plastic keys. All of the things that we do are in fulfillment of this dominion mandate. There's no secular work and sacred work, because there's no world that's not his. So let's pray that God would make us a people like those in the days of Nehemiah who have a mind to work. And let's do it joyfully, remembering that he's made us stewards in his kingdom. Let's pray. Our good and gracious Father, again we thank you that you have chosen us to be your stewards. And Father, we ask that you would make us more mindful of our calling, that we would rejoice more fully in the opportunity we have to reflect your glory in the creation of the world. We ask that you would make us more joyful and more mindful of the fact that we, the church, have been made a helper suitable to the second Adam. That you would give us a joy and a confidence in knowing that he is indeed bringing all things into submission, that he is gardenizing all of reality. So, Father, make us joyful workers. And tomorrow, Father, make us joyful resters. For we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.
If you would like more information about Forge Ministries, including information about our upcoming events, please visit us on the web at forgeministries.org.